Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2015, a beautiful Monday morning, unlike a week ago, and we sit here calmly for Menuchat HaNefesh, and we have to acknowledge Tzva Hagana Yisrael. I can never forget the moment when Ben-Gurion said, Hine lo yonim velo yishan shomei Yisrael, in the YU auditorium, thousands of people present. And a chassid got up and shouted, "Du meinst der Eibishter or the Tzahal? Do you mean God or do you mean the army?" And Ben-Gurion very judiciously answered, "I mean both." And we have to be thankful to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and we have to be very thankful to the Tzva Hagana Yisrael. I need not elaborate, you all know what I'm saying. Now, let me begin at the beginning. In last week's shiur, we spoke about David Eliezeri's book, and David Eliezeri just sent me a message, a number of matters, but also a mazel tov on my grandson's wedding. We're still in Sheva Brachot. And he then says to a Litvak like myself, you should not only have nachat, but a little chassidish nachas. What he doesn't realize, of all my grandsons, this is the one who a year ago went to Uman, and this past Shabbat, in the middle of their Sheva Brachas, everyone wanted to make on this end of the ocean, they went to Tzvat, to spend Shabbat in Tzvat. So you can draw your own conclusions that either David Eliezeri is a prophet, or Nibay de lo yorda mashenibay. Okay, now, about some of the questions that we've raised, and Rabbi Rubin is not fair, do me a favor, Jay, tell him off. This is for him now, and he's not here. We mentioned in class about Rabbi Werfel, the Orthodox rabbi killed in World War II, so my Talmud, Rabbi Dr. Wiener, who was a chaplain in the American Army, Mark, sent me a whole print out here for chaplains. There were more Orthodox chaplains killed in World War II. But once again, it's not my mistake. I was quoting a source that he said he was the only one. He's the only one killed in battle from enemy fire. A number of chaplains were killed simply in accidents. But there's a very interesting article here, and at the end, the actual monument photographs of what was put up in their memory. Now, I want to also mention something going back to my Monday classes many, many years ago, but I was happy, I have to say, I have to give credit, because the Haredi world does not function in the same world that we function, and a book just came out on Rabban Shel Kol B'nei HaGolah Toldot Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi Mibris Chelek Aleph by Rabbi Shimon Mela. He's published on the Bris family quite a number of books. I know actually his wife, she was on the boat when we came in Aliyah. Her family was coming back, at least, the mother was also Israeli, if I'm not mistaken. Her family was coming back from after spending a number of years in America, and that little girl married Rabbi Miller. Now, when you come to Reb Chaim Briska, there's the very important question. Why did Yeshivat Volozhin close down? Anyone raised in a Naguda school in Beit Yaakov, Chinuch Atzmai, anyone raised in Ponovich, in Lakewood, you will hear time and again that Volozhin was closed down because they refused to introduce a few hours of secular studies, particularly the Russian language. And I was raised on this too, and there's no question, and I studied the topic. It's not for me to lecture on it now, but I've lectured in the past. Maybe if God will spare me in the future, I'll go into much more detail. But the Lashon Yeshiva from the 50s through the early 90s, they were constantly playing a game with the government. A little Russian language, a little mathematics, a core curriculum, yes, no, minimum, bribes, get away, a fleshel bremsen, if you know that expression. When the guy came in, you give him a little schnapps to drink, and you tell him, here, the kids all speak Russian. When the communist empire fell, the archives of the Secret Service opened up. and we actually had the documents from the 1880s into 1890 when the yeshiva was closed in 1892. And believe it or not, the reason the government closed down the yeshiva, of course they knew that they were playing games with the Russian language, but that didn't bother them. What bothered them was the machloket over who will be the next Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Chaim Berliner, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And this was a time when they were shooting at the Tsar, and the government was frightened stiff if yeshiva boys can rebel against rabbis and fight an open battle in the yeshiva, Allah kama bakama, they can become revolutionaries and fight against the Tsar. And that's why they closed the yeshiva down. Now, it's very fascinating. Yishol Stamfer, a Talmud Chaver of mine, did a doctorate at Hebrew U, a magnificent doctorate on the Lushan, on the yeshiva in Eastern Europe. Do you know that he had to issue a second version of his doctorate after the fall of the communist empire, totally revising with documents translated into Hebrew, why the yeshiva closed down? So here I am reading when I'm tired at night and I can't do anything deep. So I read biographies of Gedolei Yisrael. That's my big Yetzahara. So I show my Talmud, Rabbi Reuven Unger of Shalavim, lent me this volume, said, Rebbe, you'll enjoy it. And it's not scientific, it's not scholarly, but a lot of nice information. I have to give credit. At the end of this whole chapter on why Balazhin closed down, beginning on page 400, he goes, Mahaya Hamaka Bepatish. Do you know what that expression means? What was the final on Shabbos, the Makkah B'Patish? What closed the circuit? And believe it or not, he goes into the documents and cites them and quotes them. It's just a shame he doesn't, you know, quote the thesis by Shol Stumpf for the second edition at Hebrew University. But I have to say, I was impressed that he could quote it. Now, coming back to our world, I asked the question, what your Belinda means. So Elliot Feinerman, my dear student, and I send regards, sent me a printout of everything you want to know about your Belinda. And what it means is, dear, beautiful Yorba. It's named after the Yorba family and beautiful Yorba. These were beautiful people who built that community. Yitzko, we're now in 770, in relation to something I said last week about the Rebbe, and everyone looks at a Rebbe lighting candles, davening, and everything becomes a big ceremony, the burning of the chametz. So it's true. The Lubavitcher Rebbe made comments more than once. Was kookt men an? Ich bin ein älterer Jid, was davent? What are people looking at me? I'm an older Jew who davens. And in Lubavitch, there are no big ceremonies out of lighting Hanukkah candles or out of burning chametz. Everything is done. A Jew has to do what he has to do. So Yitzchok sent me a very interesting comment. In regards to your previous share, I have to say that in your talk regarding looking at the Rebbeim while davening, that in fact it was done in Chabad before other Hasidim. However, unlike some Rebbe Balach who create the spectacle, the Rebbe himself did not perform and at times castigated people for looking at him during and davening and not focusing on their own davening. Okay, and that I remember Tzvi Groner telling me that the Rebbe told, was cooked on, an elderly yid, was davened. But as time moved on, the Rebbe allowed his bimah to be placed at a higher level so more people could see him. What has been done was to use the Rebbe's derech to educate children, like taking the Rebbe's clear and concise reading of davening. Not too slow, not too quick, saying every word, including certain havarat of specific words, and using it as an education tool, how to daven properly. In addition to use a siddur to say every daven shebe kedusha and not rely on memory. So that's an interesting comment. And Einoch Hinami, there's a lot you can learn by watching an Adam Gadol daven and listening to the way he pronounces the words and the pace that he davens at. And you should know that's one of the biggest problems in our method of davening. In my shul, they're two balei tefillah, at my minyan. They take turns. One day one guy, one day the other guy, two very successful people. One a world famous professor at Hebrew U, the other one a very famous businessman in Israel. And let me tell you, I can't keep up with either of them. I start Pesukei Gezimra when they haven't started Mizmashiach Hanukkah Bayit L'David yet. Dai L'Chatima. But Balei Tshuva have told me so many times, davening in a weekday morning shul is impossible. And think about it. Balei Tshuva, you know, we're used for davening. There's an expression that the Mori Rebbe used to say, daven nicht up the Gemara wie min sagt Ashrei. Don't daven up the Gemara like you're saying Ashrei Yishrei Betecha. You've heard that expression? It's an old Litvisher expression. And for Baal Tshuva, it's very difficult. But now the most fascinating comment, and you're not going to believe what I'm going to show you. I can't believe it either. So here I raised the question, did the Rebbe stand during a maimah or didn't he stand? Right? And I read their descriptions, and I remember the Rebbe standing, holding the handkerchief, tying Rabbi Kalushkin's description. Well, let me tell you, the Rebbe did both. The Rebbe would sit when he said the maimer, this is from Yitz Gold, with his eyes usually closed, and his hands were usually held under the tablecloth, and not visible to the public, grounding himself. Now, from Rafael Dovir Gurevich, also 770. You mentioned in your shiur the 26th of October that you were not sure if the Rebbe Surah sat during his Maimarim. Actually, both are true. Up to the Rebbetzin's passing in 1988, when the Rebbe stopped having weekday Fabrangens, he would sit during a Maimar while the crowd would stand. After 1988, there were times that the Rebbe would say a surprised maimer right after Mincha Maariv, where he was davening. The Gavoyim would rush to bring a shtender for him to lean on. So the Rebbe mostly sat, but a handful of times he stood leaning on a shtender. And believe it or not, two pictures were enclosed with the Rebbe saying a maimer. Here he's sitting, and everyone is standing around him. Amazing. Okay. And you can't see what the Rebbe is doing with his hands. Here he's standing, and everyone is standing around him, and he's holding a handkerchief in his hands. So it shows you that here we are in the year 2015, we're asking ourselves, what did the Rebbe do? And take a look. You don't have a black and white answer. Even more, you have two different photos that show the Rebbe doing both. I have to say, I found this very, very moving. Very moving. Very interesting. And it takes me back. People constantly ask me, what did the Rebbe do? What did the Rebbe do? And I always tell them, look, I didn't grow up in Boston. You want to know what the Rebbe did in Boston? Ask Rabbi Rubin. Ask Jay. No, he never gave shift standing. That's for health reasons. That's a different story. I'm not asking about that. But they ask about davening. Yeah, even in the early days. About did he say this? Didn't he say this? How did he say it? When did he say it? And I always say, yes, Rabbi Rubin. And you'll see, you'll get conflicting reports. Yes, Jay?
You know, there's a marvelous volume that was published by Rabbi Bendigo.
Yeah, I have the volume.
Which documents all of
the... Where he documents, and he evidently was very close to the Rabbi. He's Shtikla Gabbai, the family there. So they knew what was going on. But it's an amazing thing. Also, you can open up Rav Heschel, one of his volumes, and you'll get a contradiction between Rav Heschel from New York and Mendelgut in Brookline. Okay. Now, I'm ready to go further. I just want to say, Vasav Migazak, let's the Noah, you're coming in the middle, but nevertheless, here's the man, Yitzchak. Ay, God, what can I do? You missed, let me continue. Now I'm ready to end the shiur. Vasav Migazak, let's the Bach. So last week we finished out the Dirab Tachtonim. And we spoke about Rav Shmaya Guraye, and I want you to appreciate that this person, who should have been Rebbe, could have been Rebbe, everyone thought he would be Rebbe, and he became a devoted chassid of the seventh Rebbe, and with all the family inferences that we spoke about. But now I want to go further. Until now, let me make an analogy. In the state of Israel today, Moriah Rebbe, the name Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, is very popular. Everyone is trying to figure out who the Rav was. Doctorates are done at Hebrew U. People interview me, interview other people. And you get a total picture of the Rav that is so different from who he really was, it's almost like night to day. Part of it is the Rav's fault, because Moriah Rebbe, and I can't go back to my lectures now on the Rav, but Moriah Rebbe, when it came to Dvar Hashem Zu Halacha, he was a briskum, he was a perfectionist, so what you have circulating all over Israel in good modern Hebrew are his Hashkafa talks, his philosophic talks, very little of Ishas and Paiskim and Brisk and Chidushim and Hitzitkut. They don't stop to comprehend who the Rav was. He was, you could actually say, when you read about him, and I've seen some of the doctorates, and a doctor was just done by a woman who I know her mother is very close to my wife, and she just did a doctorate on the status of women in halacha and the whole question of tavla meitiv tandu meile meitiv armala. Is it better for women to grow old alone or to grow with any type of man? And she deals with Rabbi Rachman and Rabbi Soloveitchik, and she cites me as one of the ones who's telling her what the Rav held, and she cites others from here that don't even start to comprehend who the man was. But this is the reality, because the Rav was a lot more than many other Gedolei Yisrael. You take Rav Aaron Chudli, you take Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Avadya Yosef, it's not difficult to define them. The Rav, Ger V'Toshav, because he had a duality to him, he was brisk, and yet he lived in Boston, okay? And he was a Ger and a Toshav. So to really comprehend the Rav, you have to see both aspects of him. Not many can do it yet. I hope within 100 to 200 years, this will be rectified. Now, the Lubavitcher Rebbe that we dealt with until now, you can walk away with the opinion, who is the Rebbe? And by the way, this is why Rabbi Klushkin's book, some of the Chabotnikim, criticized it. He sees the Rebbe too modern, too worldly, too Western, I'll use that word. And you take everything we spoke about in class, the revolutionary person, stand on street corners, put on tefillin, who was the Rebbe? So every word I've told you until now, Baruch Hashem, I believe is true, even though we can't establish what the Rebbe's principle was about standing or sitting during a maimah, but every word you've said until now is based upon fact. This is the Rebbe. But now I want to say, with all that we've said until now, what's amazing about the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, his basic gestalt was a Hasidic Rebbe with all that that implies. And I will spend the next hour illustrating what I'm talking about. Jerome Mintz, we've mentioned this name before. He's not alive. I never met him. I regret that I never met him. I'd like to know more about him. If anyone listening knows more about him, I've seen the Wikipedia entry, but it doesn't tell me who he was, whether he was a Shomer Mitzvah, what background he came from. Jerome Mintz did a doctorate on the Hasidic world. I know of two magnificent volumes that he put out. He taught in the Midwest, I believe. And I'm holding in front of me, this is a precious book. It was the last book I bought as an American, as a Gentile, as an Oved Avodah Zarah. The last book I bought before I came in Aliyah. And that's an open Gemara, Hadar B'chutz Laretz, Ke'ilu Oved Avodah Zarah. Jerome R. Mintz, Legends of the Hasidim. I believe this is based upon his doctorate. In this book, he tells stories about Hasidic Rebbeim in the New World, in America. And this story I'm about to tell you is, I cannot tell you how famous this story was. Why? It was part of Herbert Wiener. We spoke about Rabbi Wiener last week. This Rabbi Wiener, in 1957, published an article and commentary on what was happening in New York. I can give you the name of the article. It may be online. The Lubavitcher Movement, Commentary 23, 1957, page 231. I'm quoting it. Mintz, in his doctorate, quotes this as one of the stories of the Rebbeim in America. Now, why was this so important? Why do I say that this article, this commentary article, Rabbi Herbert Wiener, a Reformed rabbi, put the Rebbe into the mainstream? And here you have to understand, and I've said this many times, and all of you, if you don't know it yourself, ask your grandparents, your great-grandparents. In America in the 50s, Orthodoxy was laughed at. Orthodoxy, no future. A guy named Rakefet wrote a volume on Reb Lazer Silver, the Silver Era. They called Orthodoxy a weak reed from Europe that will be stumped out in the United States. Who cared? The New York Times, when they wrote about a Jewish topic, they interviewed Reform rabbis, conservative rabbis, but Orthodox rabbis, man dechashme. I remember when Look magazine, Life magazine had articles in just about this time on Orthodoxy in America. Remember, the Rav, his picture, had to be the late 50s. We couldn't believe it. We were so proud. The world is acknowledging we exist. This article appeared in Commentary. Commentary wasn't a religious magazine. This was a mainstream magazine. I believe there's still Commentary until today. Am I correct? It's considered more Zionistic and more right-wing politically than some other magazines. And they're writing about the Rebbe, and a Reform rabbi is writing. Okay, I'm now quoting this article, this entry. Professor Mintz calls the soldier. The old rabbi was the first Rebbe who created the movement which we now call Chabad. Now the Lubavitcher Rebbe lives in Brooklyn. Remember, he's talking to people who are totally ignorant. We are telling a story about this Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe. He should be well. One time a soldier went to the Rebbe before he went to Korea. By the way, he's interviewing a Lubavitcher Chassid. It's a sociological study. It's like Gershon Kranzler's doctorate, where he interviews survivors, Williamsburg. You're familiar with that? Gershon Kranzler, George Kranzler, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, I knew him very well. Wonderful, wonderful individual, Torah Vadas graduate. His son David, a big Kranzler family, it's today part of YU. He was a Torah Vadas boy, and he did a doctorate at the New School of Social Research of Columbia University on Williamsburg. And this is one of the techniques.
New School or Columbia?
I believe it's called, isn't the New School under the Aegis? No, it's two separate things. Who runs the New School of Social?
It's its own university.
Its own? I don't know. All right, so it could be, I'm pretty sure, check it out on the computer. I'm pretty sure it was done at the New School of Social Research. Okay. Do they have a college? I've never heard of a college there. Oh, so it's only a graduate school.
No, they have undergrad programs also.
Yeah,
I studied there when I was in high school.
Boy, you have really conquered the world with study. How many years are you in philosophy? 20? 20? Kala kavod, all right. I bow to you. Whenever I'm wrong on a philosophical issue, you correct me 100%. You follow? Part of scholarship is to know what you know and what you don't know. You follow? This morning I know more than Yitz because he doesn't know that the Mets disgraced New York. That you don't know. 12 innings. Okay, you should have seen the scene here. They were crying. Oh my gosh.
I think you were the only one.
I'm crying.
This is the generation that doesn't care about baseball.
If you would have seen, boy, oh boy, you should have been here at 6:30. You would have seen how many kids were cramped into the office watching the ball game. I mean, what a world. They're in Israel, and they're the New York Mets right in front of your eyes, the Kansas City Royals. I still remember when they bought me a ticket to the Yutet Kislev Fabreng, and I come into Binyanei Huma, this has to be in the late 70s, early 80s, thousands of people, and there, 10 o'clock New York time, the Rebbe is walking into the Fabreng, and right in front of me, live, I couldn't believe what a world we live in. And that was in the late 70s, off a satellite. Imagine where we are today, but boy, their joy turned to sorrow, the 12th inning. Anyway, we are telling the story, he should be well. One time a soldier went to the Rebbe before he went to Korea. The soldier did not know much about Jewish ways. The Rebbe told him that he should follow all the good deeds he could do, especially the mitzvah of washing their hands before eating bread. Before a person eats, he should wash his hands with a small glass of water and say a prayer. In the beginning, the soldier did not know what the Rebbe meant, but he asked, they explained. Now, I just want to interrupt. You see what's happening here? Imagine you go to the Rebbe, a typical American kid. You don't know much about Yiddishkeit. You barely had a bar mitzvah. Right, a kid growing up in America, but there are no atheists in foxholes. The kid may live in Brooklyn. People told him you're being shipped over to Korea. Get a bracha from this Hasidic Rebbe. Won't hurt. So the soldier goes to Korea. At the time, there was a great big war, and he did all the commandments that he knew, but especially washing his hands before eating. One time, all the soldiers were sitting around. They wanted to eat. Then all the soldiers took out their food and began to eat. And so did our soldier who went to visit the Rebbe. He took out a little piece of bread and he thought, I haven't got any water here to wash my hands. What should he do? It is told that in a person there are two ways, a good way and a bad way. One has nothing to do with the other. So the good side says, the Rebbe told you to look for water, go look. He wanted to go and look, as the good side told him. But the other side said, no, what does the Rebbe mean? Should he look for water in the middle of a desert? The Rebbe thought that if there is a sink with water, then you go wash yourself. Just as he was getting to eat, he caught himself and said, if the Rebbe said that I should abide by this law and look for water, I should go and look for water. So he went away to look. In the middle of the wilderness, and it's not an easy thing to find water, he went a long way and found water, and he washed himself in order to eat. He ate a little piece of bread. After that, he went back to his troops to be with his comrades. When he came back to all his comrades, he saw a strange thing. Where all of his comrades were alive before, there now was only smoke. Only smoke remained. The enemy had come by and threw bombs on all the soldiers. And he, who went to look for water to wash his hands was the only one left alive. Now he realized what the Rebbe, what the Lubavitcher Rebbe had told him. He should perform all the commandments, and especially the commandment to wash one's hands before you eat. No? Here's a true story. Soldier comes back, tells it. How do you accept it? No, a Litvak will say, all right, the Rebbe had mazel. You know what Rav Steinsaltz would say, and he says it in his book, Ruach HaKodesh. This is a Rebbe, the Hasidic Rebbe. All right, it's one story. Go a little further. Page 332 in the same volume by Mintz. Jerome Mintz. I wonder who he was, anyone who knows. And he's quoting from a Hasid again. Jerome Mintz, did you know him? Do you know of him, who he was on a personal level? Because he writes beautifully. He has a geschmackheit in understanding Hasidus. You're familiar with the books, right?
I have one of his books.
Which one do you have? The second?
It's called Hasidic People.
Yeah, the second book. I'm going to quote from that too. I have that too. I was leading a group of children. This is Hasid talk. I was leading a group of children on Shabbos in a shul in East New York. After I finished concluding the celebration of the Shabbos, one of the fathers who brought the children to me came up and said, I suppose you're a Lubavitcher. And I told him, of course, you guessed correctly, because more or less, Lubavitchers look the same. That itself is an interesting comment. Do you follow? Try to look at Slabodka with your own eyes, or look at Mir with your own eyes, or look at Tells with your own eyes, pre-World War II, no two students looked alike. But Hasidus, this is part of Hasidus, what I call a portable ghetto. We build a ghetto around ourselves, very, very powerful thought. Fine. So the man says to this young Lubavitcher, oh, you have a wonderful leader. Your leader is truly a great man. So I questioned him, what prompted you to make such a spontaneous statement? So he told me, do you know about 7 years ago my mother lay critically ill in a hospital after a brain operation? My mother was not expected to recover. The doctors had given up hope, and his mother was in a hospital room near the morgue. Now, the man said, I was told by a cousin of mine about the Lubavitcher Rabbi and about his blessings. So, of course, a drowning man grabs onto a straw. So immediately, it was in the middle of the night, I went to a mikveh because I realized that would be necessary. And I immersed myself in the mikveh. And I came before the Rebbe and asked the Rebbe for his blessing that my mother should recover. The Rebbe told me, take a mezuzah, wrap the mezuzah in two pieces of wax paper, and put this mezuzah under the ear of your mother. The Rebbe said, don't advertise this, don't publicize this, just do it. Of course, I thanked the Rebbe immediately, and ran to the hospital, placed the amulet under the ear of my mother, and instructed the nurses that they should leave that amulet there and under no conditions remove it. And miracle of miracles, the doctors noted a faint trace of recovery in my mother until a few months later, she was well enough to come home. Of course, we took her mother home. We forgot the amulet in the hospital. We retraced our steps to recover it. And lo and behold, we searched the hospital upside down, and the amulet was no longer there. Now, this is a classic Hasidic story. A mezuzah, a kamiya. How do you react? How do you explain it? And this is a living person giving living testimony. Tell me, How many of you know what's going on in Israel today? No, isn't this on the agenda, the public agenda? Isn't this in the newspapers? What happened in the election? What swung the overwhelming majority for Netanyahu? All right, the entertainer who made the moronic concept with their enmity, their hatred for the Sephardic masses, primitive. And how are they primitive? They visit grave sites of tzaddikim and they kiss mezuzah, right? Menashkei mezuzah. It's now become an aphorism. It's now part of our language. No? A whole group in the Knesset got together. I believe Miri Regev is one of them. And they now are going out of their way to encourage people to kiss mezuzah. Then I saw someone came up with the idea, wrap a mezuzah in two layers of wax paper, just what the Rebbe told this Jew who came to him, and keep it in your car when you drive. It will bring you bracha v'hatzlacha and protect you. All right? No, yet is your mind working? Remember, one second, remember Menachem Gordon?
That's it, I was just
going to
say.
They're going to say, all right, we're both thinking on the same level. Menachem, hold on, 1 minute, Morty. Menachem Gordon, unbelievable. They don't realize what just happened now. Menachem Gordon is a Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, was a fabulous YU guy. He was a year, he was in your class, that's right? He was a year behind me, you were a year behind me, he was a year behind me. Menachem Gordon. By the way, you know, his sister married a Satmar. Are you aware of that? His sister's married to a very wealthy Satmar with a number of homes, but a real Satmar. Maybe a closet Zionist, that could be, but outwardly a Satmar. So, Marty Gordon, very interesting guy. He taught in Stern College. He wasn't married. And he married a student. They had children, but the marriage ultimately didn't survive, which to me is very sad. If you recall, it's sad. But Marty remarried very happily, and then the Eibishter called him in. He wrote an article in Tradition on not using the mezuzah as an amulet, as a kamiya. Wrote a very strong article. And Hasidim were offended by that article. There was a big critique against him. But Marty, you know, remained Marty and published a number of articles. I think ultimately they collected them and came out with a volume of his articles. But how do you relate to the story? No, you're a Litvak. If I would tell the story to Reb Nerech Bornstein, he would jump in the ceiling. Reb Yeruchim Gerelik, I told you, we had one kid in yeshiva in my time, Chaim Nashman. Today they pronounce his name Nyman. Then it was Nashman, the Polish pronunciation. He was the only kid that went with his tzitzit out and kissed the mezuzah. When Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik saw him kissing a mezuzah, I cannot repeat because there are ladies listening to the shiur. I cannot repeat what Rabbi Yeruchim said to him in the yeshiva to the holy guy. They would go ballistic. No? Tell me, how would, again, I go back to Rabbi Avraham Steinsaltz, and no one can tell me that Rabbi Avraham Steinsaltz is not a modern man and not a genius and not learned. Rabbi Avraham is an unbelievable individual. There are very few like him, if any, now in this generation. Rabbi Avraham Steinsaltz says openly, the Rebbe had Ruach HaKodesh. This is an unbelievable story. How do you explain it? And this is the Rebbe, as a Hasidic Rebbe, no different than a Belzer and a Vishnitzer and a Gera and a Luzhina and a Boyana. You can give name after name after name after name. And I'm going to develop it further. But I see here a very big resemblance to the Rav. The Rebbe was a man of the world, a Western man, no two ways about it, but at his inner core, the basic gestalt was a Hasidic Rebbe in the full sense of the word. Morty, what did you want to say?
This past Shabbos, the Sichat HaShavua from Chabad, right, on the Halacha section, talks about that, telling people you should do that and keep it in your car.
Keep it in, so that's unbelievable, because I saw in the press, that suddenly it came up for discussion. All right, you see, we're on quicksand here, because we can either way. I mean, I have to tell you, the Rav Mela wouldn't get too upset. No, all right, they've been taught Tutman, you know, but I can't picture the Rav doing it. Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, Rav Noach Bornstein. Wow, an explosion right in front of us. Okay, and yet take a look, and the woman recovers. And I have to tell you, people call me, who am I, what am I, what can I do? People call me, I should pray for something. So I always, when people call, I always pray. And now you take it further. Let's say a person recovered, they'll say, oh, wow, I call. A lady just called me, a lady I know for many, many decades, has had a very hard life, and I taught her daughter. And so you pray, but all right, more than that I can't do. But if I hear the person recovered, I hope they're not going to say, Kefet prayed. But a Rebbe, what a little story. Now, this story repeats itself in many, many versions. Again, about this is all about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's a very fascinating book, but I only took the stories about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I saw the Lubavitcher Rebbe take away cancer with his hand. Morty, you had a story like this. Didn't you tell me? A man came in and said that he had a cancer. The Rebbe said, Sizganish, put out his hand. And at that moment, it was nothing. The man had walked in with a definite note from the doctor that he had cancer. He showed it to the Rebbe. The Rebbe said, Sizganish, and they couldn't find the cancer when they examined the person afterwards. I saw it happen with my own eyes. Nope, you've heard the story. There are many variations. Siddiq Rebbein, Sizganish, and the doctors say, why? Well, what happened here? One second. And they have no explanation. How do you explain it? But this story here is the story I love best. By the way, this story actually made the Israeli press. I remember reading it. Could be I read it in Panim El Panim or Ayin V'Ayin. You know what? That's, again, before your time, except for the people approaching my age. Originally in Israel, you know, there wasn't direct communication. And we in America, we fainted, we longed information, what's going on in Israel. So there were three brothers here. Only one is alive today, Mordechai HaKohen, who I actually see many times in the morning because he davens in the shul next to mine. When I'm finished davening, he's going to shul. And he's the youngest of the brothers. They're very interesting brothers. The eldest one was Pinchas Peli, I believe, was the eldest. Pinchas Peli, they all had different names. The original family name is HaKohen. Pinchas Peli later becomes a bit conservative. I don't want to go into details, but his family remained frum. He helped the conservative movement get a foothold in Jerusalem. Not that it ever took off, but he was the first one back in 1969, 70. As a matter of fact, I can tell you a side story that comments on Israeli life. When the conservative opened on Rehov HaGron, so the rabbinate came out against them that they have mixed seating. And Rabbi Jyoti issued a chayrim, you can't daven there. And the Jerusalem Post then, which was totally anti-religious, it's not like today, oh, they cursed Rabbi Jyoti and maledicted him. And I was an Olech Hadash, very ignorant, very naivete, to most of them be of writ. And I wrote a letter to the editor, why are they maledicting Rabbi Jyoti? And I quoted Rabbi Soloveitchik from Sanctity of the Synagogue, that he said you can't be Yotzei Shofar where they're sitting mixed. And the Jerusalem Post published my letter. No, believe it or not, I get a phone call, a message. I don't think I had a phone. I got a telegram then. Rabbi Jyoti wanted to meet me. He didn't know what to do for me. So we became very close, very good friends. So I asked people, you know, the old-time Israelis, why is Rabbi Jyoti thanking me so? I just did what is halachically correct. They said, you don't understand. In Israel, people only do things for political favors. That you went and defended Rabbi Zsolti with no interest, no self-aggrandizement, nothing out of it. This is unheard of. And they said, that's why he became your, you became your friend and wanted to meet you. But, all right, that was Rabbi. Then the middle brother was Shmuel Avidor. Remember all of them? Shmuel Avidor, also a brilliant person, a writer. He wound up in with Reform Judaism in the kibbutz. His kids went to Panovich, you should know. And he came back. Later in life, he came back. But they put out Shmuel Avidor and Pinchas Pelli. They put out a magazine called Panim El Panim. It was Ayin Ba'ayin, then Panim El Tam. It came out every Friday. I subscribed to it. The mail worked then. We didn't have email, didn't have faxes. You got it in your mailbox. And it was very important, because that's where I learned modern Hebrew. That's how I am totally, have total facility with modern Hebrew, because I had to read Panim. And this story that I'm about to tell you, I remember reading there in the 50s. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote to a man in Israel that he should go and visit someone. The man he was to see is a writer. He said, go over to him and have a talk with him and remind him he should come back to real Judaism. The man was not observant. He said that he was not, the Rebbe said he was not secure in his position and he needs a push to go back. He told him, tell that man, quote, before you go there, the man will have a dream. Tell him he had a dream that will remind him to go back to Orthodox Judaism. The man went, saw the man that Rebbe wanted him to see. He told him he should go back. The man turned white when he said he had had a dream. He said, yes, it is true. I had a dream. I know the man. I don't know if he has become Orthodox, but I saw a copy of the letter of the Rebbe to the person that was sent to him. Now, it's sad that we don't have the name of the man. I'm going to just throw out a wild guess that it was Avram Shlonsky. Avram Shlonsky was the Rebbe's first cousin. And they grew up together. The Shlonsky family, we spoke about it weeks ago. Shlonsky family and the Schneerson family. The Shlonskys came in Aliyah. He became a very famous author here in Israel. His sister, Varda, was a very famous musician. They both totally integrated and conquered the Israeli scene. They were Mapainikim, obviously, who ruled the country then, socialists, a new world, a new religion. And the Rebbe says, tell him he had a dream. No, how do you handle this? I told you, I had a dream a number of months ago. It affected my thinking, halacha lemaisa. That I said it's time to break with Chovevei Torah. Until then, I was, you know, maybe we can keep channel of communication open, but I was so shocked by a guy makes a bracha that's same-sex marriages. Obama now approves it. The Supreme Court now approves it. He makes a Shechiyonu and writes an article to justify it. And other things I saw in America. So I had a dream where I'm talking with the Rav, and the Rav is coming, his voice, and we're talking about it, and Mom is having a whole conversation. So I told the story, Kliachiyad, to my, I have one daughter who Rabbi Eliezeri would be proud, that family has a shtickl chassidus in it. And my daughter asked me about what language we spoke, and what the Rav looked like, and his voice, and she, to her, it was real that the Rav came down and spoke to me and told me what to do. I don't know. I'm caught in the middle. I'm a litvak. Can't dismiss it. The Rav, the Rebbe comes and, you had a dream. No, he said, that's right. The guy turns white. I don't know what happened afterwards. This Rav, 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 Stein thugs would have no problem. Ruach HaKodesh. Here's another story with the Rebbe. A man in Israel is very sick, and he wrote to the Lubavitcher Rebbe that he should give him a blessing. The Rebbe wrote back, blessing him and telling him he should have his tefillin examined by a scribe. The scribe found that in the saying, you should love God with all your heart and serve him with all, you love God with all your soul and serve him with all your heart, the word heart was completely missing. This is what the man had, heart trouble. They fixed the tefillin, the next day he was better. Now one second, I just got to tell you, this exactly happened to me. I'm shaking, but I have to tell you the truth. December 23rd, 1983, I was walking back to my car after teaching in Michlala and walking on this property. My car was parked on what the Machon Lev parking lot. At that time, everything was open. There were no fences, no gates. You didn't need a parking sticker. Today, you need a parking sticker. So Baruch Hashem, they still remember the chesed I did by being the Makabe Patish and getting this building for YU when it was already in the hands of David Yellen's Teachers College. So I had a nice parking spot, Machon Lev, Baruch Hashem. So I'm walking back, and there were steps in the side of the mountain here. Those steps don't exist anymore. The BMT kids named the steps Ma'alot Rakefet, because when they would see me walking, at times girls were accompanying me and the boys would run out to ask how the Rebbe is so they could look over the girls, etc. Dai l'chakim b'beramisa, Baruch Hashem, they're boys and girls in this world. And that day I tripped on rocks, I went falling, and I broke my hand, lower lane, in four places. Now, someone told me, have your tefillin checked. So right after, I had two pairs of tefillin, I still have two pairs, whatever. So, I mean, I have two different Rashi pairs, don't misunderstand me now, it's not the same time. So I had the pair that I wear every day checked, and there was a problem with the Yodacha, and it was Pasul, and they had to change the Pasha, I changed all the Pasha up then. Look, how do you explain that? Yitzchak, yes.
What we are hearing turns God into the wrathful Jehovah of the Old Testament.
Please.
In other words, we conceive our Kodesh Baruch Hu being so evil that he is going to punish a person with cardiac arrest, or God forbid, with a broken hand, because the sofer made a mistake in the film. But this turns a Kodesh Baruch Hu into an evil being.
Yitzchak, I think you are being a little bit too severe. Okay. In life, we're going to be ill, we're going to be sick. I just got a call from America. Yomo was in the office when the call came in. He saw how upset I was. This is someone I know for the 60 good years, a good person, and his son, my Talmud, called me. There's something with finances, dementia. This is someone who tells his son, I have no money left for food. And there was money there. The question is where it is, what's happened to it. I mean, you don't know what goes on. So what do you want? Life is life. But maybe a Hasidic Rebbe, look at it the opposite way, that a Hasidic Rebbe, because of his tzidkut and elichkeit, he has the ability to lift you out of the bad gezeira and give you a few more good years. Look at it that way. Don't be mad at God. Praise the Rebbe. You follow? But this is chassidus. I mean, here we're caught in a quagmire.
So I should turn my feelings not to the
No, you have to have your tefillin checked. That's all. If you suspect, that's it. Baruch Hashem. That way, I'm well aware of it. You're going to lead me into a different shayur. That's what Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And a Seifer once said to me, so I said to the Seifer, look, I'm a good boy. I bring my tefillin in every, 7 years. I just had my tefillin totally redone. By the way, the Parshiot were good. They didn't have to replace the Parshiot. And they can do miracles today because my main tefillin is a pair I bought in the early 50s. I paid a lot of money then. $50 was a fortune of money by then. And it was by a big Seifer in Yerushalayim. And I just, these tefillin, if you would see them on me a few hours ago, it's like I bought them yesterday. What they can do today in refurbishing tefillin. So I said to the Seifer, I know them, the head guy there's my student, this guy, I know the whole family. Good people. So I said to him, Rav Shlomo Zalman said we should never look at your sofrim. When you open the tefillin, I'm calling Rav Shlomo Zalman now. That's when all the problems begin, when you open them. You follow me? When they're sealed, and then they're cheskas kashrus. So he says to me, yeah, but who takes care of the tefillin like Rav Shlomo Zalman or Bach? So when I didn't want to say a word to him. Why should I hurt his feelings? You know, he might think I'm trying to cut into his parnasa. But when I walked out my time, I thought to myself, we all take care of our tefillin like Rav Shlomo Zalman or Bach. I don't think anyone in this room, tefillin or tefillin. We put them on, we wrap it up. I'm makpin on Rosh Hashanah or Rosh Chodesh, like the Rav Shita, never to start Musaf until the tefillin are wrapped up, covered by tefillin. That's what the Rav held, it's a din. You don't let the Ritzuit hang all over like people do. They throw it. I'm very makpin, all right. But, all right, it says check the tefillin, check the tefillin. We can avert the evil degree. Look at it that way. The Rebbe helps get you, buys time for you. Now here's a beautiful story. When I was expecting my first baby, at that time it was just the first year we were married. We were going through a lot of economic settling, very hard times. And certainly since I'm expecting a child, we let the Rebbe know first of all, and he sent in a very nice blessing. So first of all, this reveals a Hasidic lifestyle. Who do you tell right away? You know, when your children, when you're pregnant, when your wife is pregnant, I remember we told her parents, then my parents. I never thought of writing to the Rav or telling Rebbe, I'm expecting my first child, give me a bracha. It didn't work that way in the Litvish world. But here, the Rebbe you write to, and he sends in a bracha. And so it happened all the time I was expecting her. My husband had occasion to write in many questions about his own work, personal problems, livelihood problems, yeshivish problems. And in every letter, the Rebbe gave a strong blessing that I should have an easy pregnancy, a child that should live and be well and be strong. Not knowing any better, it was our first child. We thought that's the kind of blessing that the Rebbe gives every time. And in fact, I said, quote, isn't that nice of the Rebbe? Did you mention my pregnancy to him in this particular letter? And my husband said, no. Well, when I entered the 9th month, I had toxemia of pregnancy, a very bad case, and she was born 4.5 pounds. So we feel it was the Rebbe's blessing. Later on, we weren't even aware at the time. A few years later, we saw it in our papers, and we read the letters, and it just stares you in the face that I should have a child who lives and stays alive. And it certainly was touch and go for me and for her. I went into a coma when she was 2 days old. I was very sick. So for myself and for her, she was in an incubator. And then when she was 3 months old, she had pneumonia. And the doctor said, had it not been for penicillin, chas v'chalila. Huh? What do you do with this? And remember, we just had a case in Israel, the tears in my eyes, a woman in her early 40s, the third child, and she died in childbirth. That was last week. In Beilinson, there was similar something with poisoning, and all her systems caved in, but the doctors heroically delivered the child. The child lived, the child survived. And I said, no, I told it to my children. We just had another Baruch Hashem, a great grandchild, another one. Shortly, we take for granted, you know, pregnancy. Take a look at the Mishnah we read, Leil Shabbat, we daven Ashkenaz, Bishlos. Three sins shorten, and one of them is Lo Aleinu, they die in childbirth because of these three sins we take for granted. I can tell you something, when I went to Yeshiva Solanta elementary school, there were a number of kids in the school. It was a miut that you knew about, that their mothers were really their aunts. Did you know that? That was the tradition in Europe, that if a mother died in childbirth, a younger sister married the widow to raise the children, widower, to raise the children, because there's nothing like the love that a mother will give. Second to that is the sister of the mother. So here, you see, the Rebbe, everything should be well, the child should live. And the woman goes on, but my belief in the Rebbe is not contingent on that miracle. In fact, we weren't even aware of the miracle at that time. Until a few years later, we looked, look at these blessings. Later on in different pregnancies, I never got such blessings from the Rebbe. Just when we heard the good news that I'm pregnant, mazel tov. And then at the end, when he was told I was going into labor, when I had the baby, mazel tov and a bracha. But not in every letter that you wrote about something else that he mentions the pregnancy and the baby should be well. We didn't realize at the time how unusual it was. We figured the Rebbe does that to everybody. The wife is pregnant and he gives a strong blessing. My family is a little closer to the Rebbe. We figured that for us, three dots. But now I believe she survived only because of him. Only because the Rebbe was praying for us every step of the way. He knew I needed a blessing. It was a perfectly normal pregnancy until the end. All right? This is a Hasidic Rebbe. How do you interpret it? Again, Rabbi Reuben has a problem. He's a Litvak. He's struggling to interpret it. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz has no problem. Ruach HaKodesh. Period. Exclamation point. And remember, in all these stories where we talk about the Rebbe and pregnancies and blessings, and the Rebbe himself had no children whatsoever. And you know from the Gemara that the Mishnah, when you're in the Beit HaSurim, you can pray for others, but you can't pray for yourself. All right? It's fascinating, fascinating. And look what he accomplished. But okay, I want to go further. Fine. So you can sit there and say, very nice, Mintz did a doctorate on Hasidus in America. He interviews Hasidim. Big deal. I want to interview someone who's a die-in-the-wood, cynical Litvak. Some of you may know him. You know who I'm talking about. It's no secret. Rabbi Chaim Bravender. How many of you know Rabbi Chaim Bravender? Cynical Litvak? Is he still that way? I know him from the years back. Wow! You can't pull the wool over Herbie Bravender's eyes. He's a BTA graduate. And here, Chabad interviews him and listen to his story. And I'm reading, this is from a Chabad website, February 12th, 2015, COL Live. COL, what does that stand for? Kol Live, L has, look, it has to be Lubavitch, COL. Okay. Chabad Online, maybe that's it. Chabad Online Live. You can check it out February 12, 2015. I thank Aryeh Liebman for sending this to me. Here it is. My name is Chaim Bravender. By the way, how many of you know Chaim Bravender? I hope See, the new generation doesn't know him. He taught for many years with Rabbi Riskin. He had his own operation. He founded the Bravender's, what do they call it today?
Lindenbaum's
was originally called Bravender's. He was the founder. He has a doctorate from Tel Aviv U or Hebrew U, whatever. A very brilliant individual, very knowledgeable. He's a mechutn with Rabbi David Miller. Okay, so he's in this very institution. My name is Chaim Bravner. I was born in Brooklyn in 1941, when Brooklyn was a great center of Jewish activity. I attended modern Orthodox schools, namely the Yeshiva Flatbush, both elementary and high school. After that, I went to Yeshiva University, where I received my rabbinic ordination in 1965. After I got married, I made Aliyah to Israel. There I also learned that Hebrew U and received a doctorate in Semitic languages. He's a very brilliant individual, Herbie Bravender, Chaim Bravender. While in Israel, I felt myself drawn to learning Torah, and after that to teaching Torah, and that's basically what I've done my entire life. The story about the Sheh happened in 1967. My wife Miriam and I were living in Israel by then. And we were on a visit to New York. And although we were not Hasidim, we decided to request an audience, this means Yechiduk, with the Rebbe of Chabad. At the time, everyone understood that a blessing from the Rebbe was something worth grabbing onto. And my wife especially wanted a blessing to get pregnant because we were having a problem conceiving. So we got an appointment to see the Rebbe. The appointment was for 3 a.m. because in those days the Rebbe learned and worked all day and could only see people at night. We came into his office. We're astonished to find it in perfect order. His desk, a very big desk, was absolutely clean. There was not one piece of paper on it. I believe there was a Tehillim on the desk, and that's all. It seemed to me that there was no unfinished business in his office. Other people have a desk which is cluttered with open books, letters and other documents, all kinds of things that indicate they're in the middle of this or that. But with the Rebbe, there was nothing. Everything was in order. There was no indication that there was every single day for hours upon hours, he was producing a tremendous amount of Torah material. There was nothing to hint in that. It was almost as if the Rebbe wanted to convey a message. Right now, I have nothing else in my mind except for the two of you who are sitting in front of me. And that was quite startling to me. It's a beautiful description, by the way. And there's a lot of truth here. And the truth is, if you're going to be in the rabbinate and someone comes to you for advice, a question, guidance, encouragement, it's very smart to totally block everything else out of your mind and just let these human beings know that at that moment your only concern is their welfare. That itself is a bracha. The Rebbe started speaking to us in Yiddish. And since both Miriam and I know Yiddish, this was the language in which we conducted the conversation. The interesting thing was that the Rebbe didn't say at the outset, what do you want, or what's the purpose of the meeting. Instead, he asked us our names, where we were from, what we were doing, those sort of questions. When we mentioned that we were from Israel, he wanted to know the particulars. So I told him that we made Aliyah 2 years prior, and I was learning in the Kollel in Yerushalayim. Where do you live, the Rebbe asked. Kiryat Moshe, I said, referring to the neighborhood in Jerusalem. What street do you live on? Now everyone knows that the Rebbe never set foot in Israel. So this was a peculiar question to me. Like someone asking, oh, you come from Mongolia, what street do you live on? Like it would make any difference? But being polite, I answered the Rebbe, I live on Rehov Reines, number 13. And then he asked me, is the vegetable store still there? At first, I didn't know what he was talking about. But Miriam understood what he meant. Yes, she said, there is a vegetable store downstairs in the basement. I couldn't believe it. Everyone knows that the Rebbe had a good memory. Everyone knows that he remembers all kinds of things that other people do not usually recall. But to remember that there's a vegetable store, number 13, Rehov Reines in Kiryat Moshe in Jerusalem, when he had never set foot in Israel. Where he had never been to Israel. That seemed to be quite extraordinary. Later in the conversation, the Rebbe asked me what I was going to do with my life. I didn't have a clue about it. I was young yet. I was just interested in learning Torah. But the Rebbe said to me, look, you shouldn't just learn Torah, you should also teach Torah. You should set up a place where people who don't have the opportunity can learn Torah. You should leave Jerusalem and go someplace where they don't have yeshiva, where they can really use your talents. And he goes on to describe that as a result of the conversation with the Rebbe, he taka went into teaching Torah, set up a yeshiva, and Givat HaMiftah began. Bravendiz ultimately winds up in Efrat, then he sets up a program for women's, which winds up in the former hotel, I believe it's called the Zohar Hotel. But what an interview. And this is Chaim Bravender speaking. No one will accuse Chaim Bravender of being a Hasid. And here he's speaking of the Rebbe with Zohar. And again, I want to make a comment sideways. You think this is unique with the Rebbe? Let me tell you a little story. Our boss in the Mossad, our mafil, how do you say that in English? Mafil, mafnu in English. What's new in Yitzchak? There's a word for...
Handler.
I like the word mafil better. Our boss, Aryeh Krell, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who later gets Pras Yisrael for his work. I write about him in Washington. You can read it in English or you can read the book in Hebrew, Benetiv HaDamama. Very unique individual. So Aryeh Krell, who barely can speak English, who came from Kibbutz Sad and worked out of the office for Russian Jewry, the secret office in Tel Aviv, where he had a little apartment a few blocks away because he could be called 724, they could bother him with Pikuach Nefesh issues. So Aryeh Krell, we used to say about Aryeh, here's someone who's on the KGB wanted list. He never stayed in the same hotel two nights in a row for fear that there's spies all over. And there are spies. I can tell you stories that happened that I still shiver and shake. I'll give you a simple example. Stewie Hershkowitz, the vice president, my dear Talmud of Machon Lev, he was supposed to announce in Russia that Malka and I are coming in 2 weeks hence and to take advantage of our being there, who we are. And his passport, everything was coming in on a plane from New York, which goes into a safe. The pilot has his visa, everything he needs to get into Russia, and Stewie and it gets to France. I think he's going with his wife or whoever his partner was. And that material in a safe for him never arrived. His trip was aborted. And then Aryeh Krell told me, there's spies all over, they pay people off. They can pay off a pilot. Please don't take that. They slipped him $1,000 in cash, and that's it. He didn't take it. So Aryeh Krell, who was on the KGB wanted list, could tell you what was going on in every street, in every community in Russia where Jews lived. And when I read the story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I said, here, the Rebbe and Aryeh Krell are twins. But this is the Rebbe. What a story. That's the first part of the story. The second part of the story, you should recognize from last week. What is he telling Bravanda? Not good that you just sit and learn. Dirab tachtonim. Reach out. Accomplish. If Chaim Bravanda was sitting with Rabbi Aaron Kotler would tell him, Zeh Hashem, and learn it and call it up, and learn it, nachsanya, that means Zayin HaTalmud Chacham. It's very nice what you're doing. Learn another 10 years, another 20 years, you'll be a Talmud Chacham. But you see here the absolute difference between the Rebbe and how he approaches Herbie Bravanda, who is not a Hasid. So you see, on this level, a total Rebbe, like any other Rebbe in the world. Very similar to the Rav. The world doesn't understand that. The Rav's gestalt, an einigul from Rav Chaim Briska, a grandson. There was a lot more. That's the way I view the Rebbe. And finally, I'm going to take you a drop further. I hope I have enough time to finish. Also with the Rebbe, I want to make an important point. Being a Litvak, but having grown up by the feet of Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, so I always, from the time I got to know the Rav, let's say by 57, I had a bit of a feeling already for Chassidut. The Rav, not so much in the classroom, but in the public Shayurim, where he spoke Agada and Hashkafa, he warmed your heart up and you could feel, you could start to understand Chassidut. Then, of course, I had a teacher, I write about him in Washington. It was very fortunate. My high school years, my 4 years in the MTA were fabulous, fabulous years. What a faculty, what teachers. Unbelievable. So I was privileged. I had a new teacher my first year in high school, and I had him for 4 years. Rabbi Dr. Menachem Breyer. And Rabbi Breyer becomes the son-in-law. I was at this. I remember the engagement party of the Biyana Rebbe, and his father himself was also a Shtickler Rebbe. And Rabbi Breyer's son is today Biyana Rebbe. What are you talking about? He ate in my house. I would like to believe my house must be kasher 100%. The Biyana Rebbe ate in my house. All right. So I became very friendly, you know, I got to know Hasidus, what's going on. So I said to Menachem Breyer, I taught his daughter Nancy, I taught his son-in-law, it was my Talmud in BMT. So I said to him, Reb Menachem, tell me, people come to a Hasidic Rebbe, and they're asking you what to do, where to go, what to study. What business? Which girl to marry? All these questions. How does a Hasidic Rebbe dare to give them advice? Who are you? What do you know? What is a person's life, decisions? I mean, could you picture going to the Rav and asking him, Rebbe, I have two different girls, which one should I marry? You know, this one is this one. The Rebbe would kick you out head first. What kind of question is that? And yet a Hasidic Rebbe gets these questions day in and day out. And Rebbe Menachem Breyer had two doctorates. He had a doctorate in Jewish literature, and he had a doctorate in psychology. So he told me something I never forgot. And is it true? He said, you don't understand. Hasidic Rebbe doesn't tell you what to do. The role of a Hasidic Rebbe is to decipher what you want to do and to encourage you. And that's what a good Hasidic Rebbe does. I never forgot that. Sometimes students will come to me and ask me stupid questions. How can I make these life decisions for you? But right away. It's not hard. If you have a little intelligence, you can decipher what the student really wants to do. At that moment, you give him a backbone. And I end off the class. Here is a fabulous example of the Lubavitcher Rebbe as a classic Rebbe. And this was published October 30th, 2015, few days ago. Here's my story. This is jemedia.org, Jewish Educational Media. That's, I think, their biggest website. Chabad has quite a few different websites. And here's an interview with Mr. Elimelech Lyman of Montreal, I believe it is. Fabulous story. My father was born in the Ukraine. He grew up there. At age 20, in 1923, he left in order to avoid the Soviet draft. He traveled to Romania. There he boarded a boat, thinking he was going to the United States, but he couldn't get in. Remember, 1922, the quota went into effect, the law that they had passed the year before. So he wound up in Canada. He went into the menswear business. In 1941, the first Chabad emissaries arrived in Canada. Rabbi Kramer, Rabbi Hendel, Rabbi Greenglass. And my father developed a very close and warm relationship with Chabad in general and Rabbi Greenglass in particular. In the early 50s, my father, who had a thriving business, started to have problems. He owned an old building in Montreal. His store was on the ground floor. On the upper floors, there were small manufacturers who rented from my father. And one of these manufacturers decided it's better for him to burn down the store and collect insurance than to sell merchandise. He did it a few times till the insurance company got wise, said to my father, you have a choice. Either you install a sprinkler system throughout this old building or you tear down this old building and put up a new one. But until then, your insurance is canceled. Didn't pay to fix up the old building. My father had to build a new building. He got an architect to draw plans, a three-story building, but where do you get the money? He was so depressed, he didn't have the courage. Rabbi Greenglass saw his state of mind, how despondent he was, and said, why don't you go see the Rebbe? All right. Made an appointment, went to New York, and he tells the Rebbe the story. And the Rebbe says, show me the plans. His son went along with him, takes out the plans, the architect plans, and the Rebbe looks at it. What is this? What is that? Why only three floors? Why don't you build it bigger? If you're doing it already, do it properly. And he's telling the Rebbe, where will I get the money? And the Rebbe says, you go to the bank and you show them this will be a lucrative investment for them. You're going to make money. You're going to pay them back. You bargain with them. Get the best interest rate possible. My father walked out of the meeting a different person. In those few moments, the Rebbe changed him from being despondent and gave him confidence. Sure enough, went back to Montreal, got a good mortgage at a good rate, and built a beautiful four-story building, and it succeeded. In a year or two, a man came to him, I got a good investment. We can buy land in the suburbs outside of Montreal. It's cheap. Who knows what will be in the future? We can't go wrong. We had to come up with money. He would have to remortgage his house. His wife, this guy's mother, was opposed to, what are you crazy? We have a house. We paid off the mortgage. You're going to remortgage. You're going to buy. Who knows what will be? Went to see the Rebbe. The Rebbe told him, absolutely, go ahead, remortgage your house, invest the money. He became a 25% partner in buying up the land. 20 years later, the land was rezoned, no longer farmland, but now could be built, and land that cost about 5 cents a square foot at the outset, when they sold the land, it was now $5 a square foot. Eventually, because of this investment, my father bought a house in Israel where he made Aliyah in 1978, a happy man, all thanks to the Rebbe. Yes, Jay?
Good question. Do you think there's a reasonable distinction that can be made between this sort of cult of personality, such as we've been discussing this morning, and Das Torah that's...
I understand your question. I'll relate to it in 1 second. Just let me finish this off. You see, this is a Rebbe. She gave the man confidence. Go ahead. See, a Litvak, I don't need a Rebbe. I'm going to, you have self-confidence. It's a different attitude. But this is a Jew. A wonderful Jew. But a simple Jew. And his wife is frightened, and I can understand her. And the real estate, who knows what'll be tomorrow? We always say in my family, we could have been very wealthy. My wife's father visited Israel in 1935. There had been a tragedy in the family. His daughter drowned in Lake Placid, went through the ice. My wife has newspaper clippings of her aunt's death. It was, a terrible tragedy. So to get their mind off the tragedy, her grandfather and father visited Israel. And they could have bought up parcels of land in the center of the country. Could you imagine buying a few acres in what today is Petah Tikva or Ramat Gan? It was $100. All right, that was a lot of money then. Could you imagine that they didn't have a Rebbe behind them? Here, he in Montreal, this is Tenenbaum. You know what I'm talking about? Tenenbaum, Joe Tenenbaum, the son of the Bracha, bought up vacant land outside Taranko for pennies. What that land became worth. Joe and Faye Tenenbaum, they've given Stucker all over the world, to the Torah world. So this is a Rebbe. So you see, on one hand, we refer to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, like Rabbi Plushkin sees him, like Rakefet describes him, but never forget at the inner core, this is a Rebbe in the full sense of the word. How do you explain it? A dummy like Rakefet tries to find logical reasons. He speaks with Rabbi Breyer, the son-in-law of a big Rebbe and the father of a big Rebbe. But Rabbi Steinsaltz doesn't have to crawl up the walls and take out psychology textbooks. Ruach HaKodesh. That's the difference between his book and the other books about the Rebbe. Now, Jay Solomon doesn't realize he's quoting me. I claim in my lectures on Das Torah that Das Torah is a fallout from the Hasidic world. You see, the Hasidic world became totally Rebbe-oriented. And generally speaking, in the Hasidic world, your Rebbe was the best Rebbe, the biggest Rebbe, the most important Rebbe, the most learned Rebbe. And they followed the Rebbe blindly. Satmaruv, Gera Rebbe, Belza Rebbe, Sansa Rav. By the way, I was corrected. I always say Sansa because I heard that in my youth. It's Sansa Rav. They were not Rav. They were not. They called themselves Rav. And they were, I don't have to tell you, the Machloikis, I've lectured on extensively, between the Rushana dynasty and the Sansa dynasty, which was almost bloodshed. They wouldn't eat from each other's shrita. So when Agudat Yisrael got started in 1919, functioning, that was one of their first decisions, that Das Torah And I think it's a fallout, except in Agudat Yisrael, it's a council of sages. It's not a single Rebbe, it's a council. But as I said yesterday in class, and I said in my lectures on Das Teira years ago, Agudat Yisrael has one tremendous problem, which they have never addressed. And Mimon of Shachar, as we used to say in the Rebbe's class, Untvida'ah, either or. If Das Teira is infallible, then how come Agudat Yisrael ruled there could never be a state of Israel with Jewish sovereignty before the coming of Messiah? One or the other. If they're right, then how do you sit in the government? How does Leitzman now become the Sahar Briut? How do you have Chavrei Knesset? How do you take billions of dollars from the Israeli government to run Chinuch Atzmayi and to run Beit Yaakov, etc., etc.? Or you have to say the rabbis made a mistake and that Torah is not infallibility. Okay? But by the way, Hasidim, I agree with you. Hasidim, I agree with you wholeheartedly. But I'm quoting Eder Charedit now. Al HaChoma. You ever read Al HaChoma? Eder Charedit publication, I think it's weekly. Read some of their articles against Agudat Yisrael.
And you, they think that
they were all... Yeah, they quote just what I'm saying to you. What b'shoyim, what up b'karsim, mi b'tel, et ma b'pchaim, oizik rejimki, v'achav etzchaim, v'agere rebi, etc., etc. But a lot of Hasidim criticized me when I gave those lectures because they said, you're missing... Yes, halacha l'maaser, a chassid will follow a rebbe. True. But I'm missing the first part, that a rebbe cares about the chassidim. He's a father figure. He's concerned with every chassid. You can't say that about the Mo'etzet Gedolei HaTorah. But anyway, I think there's an interconnection, and a lot of research has been done there. Doctorates done at Bar Ilan University. Here you find there's a world of material on this topic, of Das Teira, the Hasidic world. And I agree with Alex. What I just said is an oversimplification of my critique of Agudat Yisrael. But nevertheless, the basic question remains. And if I would be an Agudist, I would say it's not that the Gedolei made a mistake, but God willed otherwise. Yeah, and what am I quoting now? The Rav in Chamesh Drashot. You follow? With Yosef, it's to me, it's the most powerful, insightful, and eternal hashkafic thought the Rav ever had. So, my dear students, first of all, ani modeh HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I haven't felt totally well these last few days. I think I cracked a rib, and I have to thank you for yesterday and today. It's been a pleasure teaching, as we said to Yitzchak a week or two ago. Absolutely, the teaching keeps us alive and young and healthy and insightful. And the Gemara in Tanit, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph, Mitam Midai Yoter Mikulam. You follow, Jason? They can't. I'm a very firm Jew. You can't change an open Gemara. I don't like people who think they're smarter than the Gemara. And I feel, wow, the Chazal hit it on the head. And if you don't believe me, look at my final quote of the Rav in Volume 2 of the Rav, the World of, where the Rav speaks about the debt to my Talmidim. I have to say to Harry Merilis with his blog, Rabbi Merilis in Chicago, and Metvi Amuna, I was overwhelmed by what you mentioned about us and our classes, and halavai I should live up to the nice words you wrote about me. But I'm very, very makitai, because a person, when he feels the world appreciates him, it certainly encourages you to go further and to do more. It's a sad day for the New Yorkers. And you know, the Rebbe lost, I lost out twice. Because everyone asked me, who are you rooting for? I say, I'm rooting for Toronto. There are more Shomer Shabbos Jews in Toronto than in Kansas City. I lost there. Then they said, who are you rooting for? Kansas City or the Mets? The Mets, they're more Shomer Shabbos Jews in New York than there are in Kansas City. So it shows you, I don't have Ruach HaKodesh. I got knocked out of the box twice. If it'd be the Yankees, then it's a different story. That I have Sherman, that I once gave a whole drasha that being a baseball fan, that's part of your youth, that's like your Judaism, it's in your blood, you can't get rid of it. The same thing with Yiddishkeit. I went further and further on that theme. So what we did today was very moving, and you got to think about it. It's not simple that with all that we've said about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, don't lose track of the fact he was a Rebbe in the full sense of the word. And not only did I bring in Hasidim, but when Herbie Bravender, Rabbi Chaim Bravender speaks about the Rebbe, you got a Litvak there. And he's a cynical guy. He's a real Litvak. I've heard him speak, I mean, years ago. He's a real Litvak. And boy, look at the way he speaks about the Rebbe. And then finally, what I had to say, very interesting. How do you have the guts to tell someone what to do? That's a Rebbe. You got to understand the person. Encourage him. And sometimes when you give that encouragement, that person can then conquer the world because the Rebbe is behind them. Okay, next week I have to tell you in advance, I'm doing something very special. I'm dealing with the Rebbe and his attitude towards women, and I'll make analogies to Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. Very fascinating who he was and how he fought. In our Sunday class, we pick up just where we left off, and we're going into the same problem in Or HaChaim, Kol Isha Eva, Saint Kriyat Shema, davening, learning, and Mirman, and you'll see Rav Menashe Klein, and I'm going to bring in ultimately Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg and the Chatam Sofer, and I'm going to bring in David Holzer's book, The Rav Thinking Aloud, and we'll have some interesting comments. Now, there's a world I want to give out. If anyone wants copies of the article I spoke about at the start of the shiur, Why the Legend Closed, I have two copies here. Welcome to it. This is for Rabbi Rubin. I trust he'll pick up the start of the shiur. He'll know what I'm talking about.
The book here on the South Africans?
No, I don't have it. It was taken. Definition of Yor Belinda, if anyone wants the information on the community. Here are more copies of Talking During Tefillah. The book is dedicated in memory of Charlie's wife's father. I have it right?
Mother.
And anyone wants copies? Four more copies. Here is Our Torah. Anyone wants copies? I see you're not interested in seeing Drushum, Halacha L'Maisa, Adarabba V'Adarabba. Here is what I spoke about yesterday, I think this is Fumori, on the analysis of electricity from Bill Gewirtz and why he corrects me. Here's what I spoke about yesterday. Those are different, though. You have to take both. Changing the Immutable from Mark B. Shapiro, what I spoke about yesterday in class, where he catches them bamtafis. This is anyone from Chabad. This is about a Yekka from the big Yekka family, Rabbi Ephraim Kalibach, how he becomes a Chabadnik and what he does in the Montreal area, reaching out. Very interesting article by his children. This is about the Allgemeine Journal and interviews with Chabad. This is about female Orthodox rabbi to be guest scholar at B'nai Jeshurun. This lady, her mother is a very dear friend of my wife, a very dear friend of our family. Her mother is the daughter of a big Talmud Chacham who went to Ramaz in my wife's time. And this is her daughter who has smicha from Shlomo Kalbach, whose yard site is now. And here, the long-lost story of the world's first woman rabbi. And this is about Regina Jonas, who wanted to get an Orthodox smicha in Germany, but couldn't. Finally, the Reform movement accepted her. A very interesting article, and this is a struggle that we'll deal with next week. Feminism, it's something going on right now. Those of you who know what happened with the RCA and Chova Ventura, NYU, it is exploding all around us at this moment in time. And we'll talk about it next week. I believe we have distributed everything. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das bedanya.